The biggest news story of Richard Stolle's career happened in Dallas 50 years ago this month. Stolle was a Life magazine bureau chief in Los Angeles, but the news of President Kennedy's assassination had him on a plane and in Dallas within hours. There he helped arrange interviews with the wife and mother of Lee Harvey Oswald and made a deal to buy the rights to the Abraham Zapruder home movie showing the assassination. Now, Life magazine has published a coffee table book on the JFK assassination with a new article by Stolle and, at his suggestion, every frame of the Zapruder film. I'm Jim Meadows. Dick Stolle joins us today on Focus. Our program continues after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. My guest today, Richard Stolle, is a native of Central Illinois, and I understand he got his start as a teenage sports reporter at his hometown paper, the Pekin Daily Times. But his major work has been with the Time Life magazine group. He's been the managing editor of Time and Life magazine and was the founding managing editor of People magazine. But it was as West Coast bureau chief at Life that Stolle covered the story of a lifetime, the assassination of President John F. Kennedy in November of 1963. Now, as we near the 50th anniversary of that event, Life magazine has published a book looking back. The Day Kennedy Died is available as a $50 coffee table book and an abridged $13 newsstand edition, and Stolle is included in a book with a vivid article on his experiences covering the assassination. Dick Stolle, welcome to Focus.
Thank you very much.
And,
Jim?
Yes.
Can I say one thing?
Sure.
You describe me as a sports reporter. I have to tell you, I was sports editor.
Sports editor, excuse me.
But, of course, we had a staff of one.
I'm sure you were very rigorous.
Okay.
You know, just for the openers here, there's so much, of course, media attention being paid to this 50th anniversary. And besides the media's love of anniversaries, why do we look back on the Kennedy assassination with this sort of curiosity?
It was kind of a mind-numbing event. I mean, I've never experienced, not even 9/11, probably because it was a single person that everybody could relate to, identify with. And I think the impact on the country, watching that funeral on Monday, it galvanized the nation in no other way that I have experienced in my lifetime.
And maybe because the media was at a point where it could bring things to Americans so quickly. I mean, I'm not sure, but I don't think the 50th anniversary of the McKinley assassination got this sort of attention.
Well, it was kind of the dawning of television coverage. Television concentrated on the funeral in Washington, not on the crime in Dallas. Network television really was kind of nowhere to be seen once the president's body went back to Washington. But their coverage of the funeral that Monday was absolutely magnificent, and it sort of taught the American television industry how to cover a huge event like that.
I know, I remember, you know, I was only 7 at the time, but I was aware enough to perceive that there was really nothing else on television for about 3 days, from the assassination to the funeral. The three major networks at the time were just doing continuous coverage of the assassination.
Right. Yes.
During the program, we welcome your calls and emails with your questions and memories of the JFK assassination. If you're too young to remember it directly, let us know what the event signifies to you. Call in at 1-800-222-9455. Our phone number, toll free, 1-800-222-WILL, and you can also email us at WILL-talk at Illinois Dick, I'm wondering if you could just put us back in that time just before the assassination. How was President Kennedy regarded in his day? We hear all the accounts comparing the Kennedy White House to Camelot, but that cannot have been a universal sentiment.
Well, the Camelot thing really was invented by Mrs. Kennedy after the assassination. But the fact remains that the country was extremely curious, tolerant of President Kennedy. He through some rough times, mostly involving Cuba, the Cuban Missile Crisis, and then before that, the dissident invasion of Cuba. The reason he went to Texas was he was having serious political problems there, and he was looking forward to a second term. He had to carry Texas. Texas was very chancy, and it's the reason he went down there. Despite all of these problems, the country there were certainly political objections to him and people who didn't like him and conservatives and all the rest. But generally speaking, America was transfixed by this incredibly handsome, glamorous president with this incredibly glamorous family. I wouldn't say reverence. He was kind of too young for that. But we had a movie star for a president. And everything he did made news, and Life magazine was the bringer of such news and pictures to America and the world.
If the trip to Texas had just been a regular trip and the assassination had not happened, would Life have covered it? Would have gotten a couple of pages of pictures?
We always covered him wherever he went. And we had a photographer and a reporter on the press bus, but of course, if Lee Harvey Oswald hadn't been up on the sixth floor of the school book depository, it maybe would have been a couple of pictures on his about his Texas trip, and that would have been it. You're absolutely right.
Now, you were the West Coast bureau chief for Life magazine, so you were in Los Angeles on November 22nd, 50 years ago. How did you first hear the news, and how did you react then?
I first heard the news. We had an AP teletype, which this is before the internet, and we had a reporter who had been a Texas city editor, and he couldn't stand not knowing what was going on in the world, so he would wander from his office to the Associated Press teletype three or four times a day just to make sure nothing was happening that he didn't know about. And he was standing in front of the teletype when those flashes and bulletins began spitting forth. Shots heard in Dallas, president may be wounded. And the first I heard of it was Tommy Thompson was his name, shouting, "Dick, Kennedy's been shot in Dallas." And I ran out to the AP machine, watched it for a minute or two. It became aware something big had happened there. I ran back to my office, called New York on the phone. They had just gotten the same news. I said, "What can we do?" And the orders were clear. How fast can you get to Dallas?
So that's what you did that day. You and I guess Tommy Thompson got on a plane to Dallas.
We did, and fortunately, two photographers were in the bureau at the time with their equipment. Thank God. And I said, "Okay, we're all going." I mean, we didn't, no bags packed, nothing. We just ran for the airport, and we heard just as we were going into LA airport that the president died. And Tommy and I were being driven there by another colleague. Tommy emitted a groan that I can remember to this day. Then we all piled on this National Airlines plane about an hour after we heard the news, and by about 4 o'clock, we were in Dallas.
You just mentioned Tommy Thompson's reaction. You know, this was a big story, but it was also a big blow to the country. Did you yourself experience, you know, a personal reaction as well as the professional one?
To be truthful, not until I got back to L.A. I think most journalists know, and Tommy certainly could not have been more professional once he got there. But reporters learn to just kind of put their emotions aside, and it's what all of us did there. We didn't have much time to watch TV. We didn't watch as the tearful nation watched on Monday the funeral. And it's interesting. You mentioned the book we've done, The Day Kennedy Died. It was when I was preparing. I went back and did some reporting, looked at files that I had. And in a sense, I relived that weekend in an emotional way, writing that story in a way that I did not at the time.
That's very interesting. 50 years later, all of this 50 years later, all of this coming back to you. And I know that that article is very vivid and detailed. It just seems like no time had passed at all. I want, you know, at this point, Dick, this is where I'd like to set the scene in terms of where the news media was in 1963, because the media landscape has changed so much. And the coffee table edition of The Day Kennedy Died includes a facsimile edition of the issue of Life that reported the Kennedy assassination. Now, my producer, Lindsay Moon, who's a lot younger than you and I, took a look at it, and she was very impressed just by the physical size of the magazine. I believe she actually wondered if perhaps it was being printed larger than its original size.
No, that's life was outsized back then.
And really a lot of magazines were. I think everything from Ladies' Home Journal to Boy's Life was in that big format. But can you talk about the prominence a magazine like Life had in the news media landscape a half century ago?
Well, it was a picture magazine. We ran a lot of words, but we emphasized the photographs, which is why getting this Spruder film for Life was so critical for me. It came out every week. Our biggest competitor was Look, but it came out only every other week. Network television, at the time of the Kennedy assassination, had been on for half an hour, only a few months. It had been 15 minutes before then.
The evening network newscasts.
Yes, exactly, the evening newscasts. And so for many Americans, for millions of Americans, Life was their window on the world. We had correspondents and photographers everywhere. We covered everything, and Life would come on Friday into American homes, and I've heard this so many times I can't imagine, that there would be a big fight to see who would get the magazine first and page through it and find out not only what was happening in the world, but more important, what it looked like.
We are talking about the assassination of President John Kennedy, which happened 50 years ago, November 22nd. Our guide is Pekin, Illinois native Dick Stolle, who was on the staff of Life magazine and covered the assassination. He has a new article about that event in the Life magazine book, The Day Kennedy Died. There's also an excerpt from that article in an issue of Time magazine from last month. We welcome your questions, comments, or memories at 1-800-222-9455 or email us at wyll-talk@illinois.edu. And that phone number again is 1-800-222-WILL. Let me go ahead and take a phone call. Steve from Champaign, good morning. You're on Focus.
Yeah, hi, good morning. Enjoying the show. It's hard to believe it's been 50 years. I suppose it's one of those events, you know, I suppose much like Pearl Harbor or 9/11, that I'm 58, and I can recall like it was yesterday, Catholic grammar school on the south side of Chicago, and having the nuns cry, and just amazing. But I wanted to ask your guest two quick questions that I'll ring off. As far as the event itself, I have an 18-year-old daughter, and of course she can't put her mind around this, and all of this is coming back, and she said, I don't understand, why is this so important? Why is everybody talking about it? And I was wondering if your guest maybe could talk to his perspective as to if he would, if the country would have changed if, you know, that those events would have never happened. I mean, it's, I suppose it's hindsight's 20/20, but Vietnam and Watergate and all those things, we kind of took a hard left after Kennedy assassination. I was wondering if he thought the country would have been different and why it's such a seminal event. And then finally, if his own personal beliefs, if he thought Lee Harvey acted alone. And I'll ring off. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Dick, that first question, if Kennedy had lived, maybe been reelected to a second term, how do you think the issues he would have handled the issues facing the nation at that time?
He was a terrific speaker and unbelievably articulate, and he articulated goals for America in those first 3 years that I think he would have tried very hard to accomplish if he had a second term. Now, Lyndon Johnson was better at manipulating Congress than Kennedy was. And that's why those civil rights bills were passed by Johnson. They were proposed by Kennedy, and Johnson got them passed. I think it's very likely that those bills would have been passed in the second term, that I think the glamour would not have worn off. The fact that President Kennedy was misbehaving unbelievably during all of this, it's unlikely that that would have come out. The reporters were very, very cautious in their coverage, and a lot of them knew what was going on. So I think that Kennedy, with a second term, would very likely, and Vietnam, I don't know, who knows? It's I don't think he had that kind of Texas macho attitude that Johnson had that I think prevented him in many ways from pulling out of Vietnam. But I suspect that Kennedy, in two terms, would have gone down as a very successful and memorable president.
Do you think much would have changed from what happened under the Johnson administration in terms of policies and decisions?
Well, it's very likely there would not have been a Johnson administration. I mean, Johnson, at the end of his second term, assuming even that he would have been vice president, and there was certainly some agitation within the Kennedy camp of replacing him. Kennedys didn't like Johnson, and Johnson and his people didn't like the Kennedys.
So maybe in a second term there would have been a different vice president.
It's very
on the
possible,
ticket.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And Johnson at that point was getting on in years. We just had a very young President Kennedy, and I think I question seriously whether Johnson would have been elected president on his own.
Let me get to one big subject, because we're already getting a couple of callers asking about that, and that's about the home movie that Abraham Zapruder took of the presidential motorcade, which on which can be seen the shooting of John Kennedy. You negotiated with Abraham Zapruder to get the rights to that film for Life magazine. How did those events play out?
Well, this plane that we all took to Dallas got us in about 4. I went in, set up an office in the Adolphus Hotel in downtown Dallas, and about 2 hours, about 6 o'clock, I got a phone call from a part-time Life correspondent, a stringer, as we called him, who had been at Dallas PD all afternoon, gone home to feed her children, got a phone call from a reporter friend who said he'd heard from a cop. This is the way things are. You know, the reporter heard from a cop, and he calls our reporter, and the reporter calls me. Anyway, that a businessman had been in Dealey Plaza with a movie camera and was said to have photographed the assassination. And I thought, good God. And I said, well, how do we find? Who is this man? She said, I can't. He didn't spell it for me, but he pronounced it. And she pronounced it Zapruder. Didn't have a first name. I'd never been in Dallas before, so I picked up the phone book.
That's when phone books were useful reference.
Being a very important research tool back then, yes. And I simply ran my finger down to Z's, and my God, there it was. Zapruder, comma, Abraham, and then the phone number. I started calling, and called every 15 minutes for the next 5 hours. And at 11 o'clock, this weary voice answered, and it was, I determined that it was Mr. Zapruder, that he had indeed photographed the assassination. He'd seen it. He had gotten the whole thing. I asked if I could come out and see the film right then. He said, please don't. He said, I've had a terrible day, which is, to put it mildly. And he said, come to my office at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. And because I knew that other reporters were going to become in possession of this same information, I got there an hour early. I got there at 8.
And, you know, you really had to size Mr. Zapruder up really quickly to decide how to talk to him and convince him to let Life use the film. What were your impressions of Abraham Zapruder?
He was a grieving man, mostly. But he was a businessman and a good one. And he was as businesslike as he could possibly be. He showed us the film. He said, when I got there, looked slightly annoyed that I was an hour early, but he said, I'm about to show the film to two Secret Service agents. He says, so you might as well come in. So I did and saw it, this incredible piece of film for the first time. Realized that Life had to have it. And when the time came, other reporters, of course, showed up, as I suspected. He showed the film to them. I disappeared. I went out into. I said, can I sit somewhere else, Mr. Zapruder? And he put me out in with his office staff, where I met his secretary, his assistant, was from Taylorville, Illinois.
That's right, central Illinois, not far from Springfield.
Well, that's right. When she told me that, I said, Taylorville is terrific basketball team. And so we talked about high school basketball, and we got along very well. And as it turned out, that became very important to Mr. Zapruder. But the time came, he showed the film to the other reporters, and then he gathered us all out in the hall, and he said, I know you want to speak to me. One by one, I said, but he said, Mr. Stolley there from Life was the first reporter to contact me, so I feel obliged to talk to him first. Well, the other reporters went berserk when they heard that and began screaming, shouting, don't sign anything, promise you'll talk to us. And I just kind of melted away, and we went into his office, and an hour later, I had the film.
Now, you had to make some choices. It's in that next issue of Life magazine where you publish several frames from that movie. You don't publish everything, of course, but how did you make the decisions as to...
Well, first of all, I didn't. I stayed in Dallas to cover the rest of the story, and a courier took the film. We had set up an emergency office at the printing plant, the Donnelly printing plant in Chicago, and they made the decision not to run the kind of infamous frame 313, which is when the president's head explodes. They felt that this would be too disturbing to the Kennedy family, and so they didn't run that particular frame. They They ran the others. President clutching his throat after he'd been hit in the back. Mrs. Kennedy crawling along the trunk, trying to get away, in my opinion, the Secret Service agent jumping on the limousine, pushing her back into the seat. All of that was there. The headshot was not, and for humanitarian reasons.
Did you, you know, of course, over the years, there have been so many theories built up, many of them based on what is in or not in this film. Were you even able to, were your people even able to study the film that carefully to, you know, to figure out what was going on in terms of selecting the frames?
Well, it's kind of fascinating. I have my own theory. The Zapruder film, I mean, there is a kind of historic ambiguity to it. The Zapruder film, to me, is the best argument that exists for a single shooter, and it's the best argument that exists for a conspiracy.
Both at once.
Both at the same time. I mean, there are things in the film, the president, after the terrible headshot, the president's body slams back into the back seat of the limousine. Conspiracy people say that proves there was a shot from the grassy knoll, and that's what slammed him back into the seat. Neurologists, pathologists say because of the massive wound to the brain, that was a kind of a galvanic response, muscular response, that slammed him back in there, that there was no shooter, another shooter in the grassy knoll.
Okay, so it depends on interpretation here.
Exactly.
Now, in The Day Kennedy Died, in the book, the book does reprint every frame in color this time.
Yes.
From the Zapruder film. But if I read correctly, it's also written that the film was damaged to some extent during processing. I'm not sure if that's during the initial processing or later, and that a few frames, like maybe half a dozen, are missing?
About three or four, yes. And that was done when I sent the film up to Chicago. Life made a... We had to run in black and white because we didn't have time to do color. Color took several days back then. They made a black and white prints, and then they made, individual prints of frames, and then they made a print of the film itself, which is what they sent to New York so they could see it. And in doing so, two or three, four, possibly, frames were damaged, and they had to cut them out. But they were early in the film. They were not important to what was going on.
And, of course, that's not going to satisfy a lot of people if some people on the scene that could be crucial to the events.
Well, I myself am named in two conspiracy plots.
Well.
I know. How about that?
I didn't know I was talking to someone so important.
Yes, attention must be paid here to this conspirator. Yes, one of them is that I took the film. I got the film from Mrs. Bruder, and I went immediately to a secret CIA photo lab outside Dallas where they diddled with the frames and rearranged them in order to cover up the fact that there were multiple shooters. Now, don't expect me to explain that, but that's one of them. And the second is that I was arrested by a Texas policeman when I tried to get a suitcase full of cash to Marina Oswald.
Okay.
I plead not guilty to both charges.
We have an email from Jack in Champaign, and if this is correct, I understand that the film, the Zapruder film, was not shown on television for many years. We just saw the still photos. Why was that?
There are two reasons for it. One is that when I was negotiating with Mrs. Zapruder, he pleaded with me. He said, whoever gets this film I do not want them to exploit it. And he used that word repeatedly. And he said, as a matter of fact, you know, I want that to be in any kind of contract that I sign. That day, I negotiated only for print rights. That was on Saturday. I came back on Monday after the New York editors and Henry Luce himself had seen the film, and they said, we want to get all rights. So I paid $50,000 on Friday, and on Monday I paid an additional $100,000, and Time Incorporated Life had all rights. We decided, partly for competitive reasons and partly in keeping with Mr. Zapruder's plea and our agreement not to exploit it, that we felt that we did not want it seen on television, and it wasn't. Your caller is absolutely right. Until 1975, when Geraldo Rivera put on a bootleg copy that is an illegal copy on ABC television.
Now today the film is widely available. I understand that Life magazine returned the rights to the film to the Zapruder family, and it was subsequently bought by the federal government. I guess not for hiding or anything, but for essentially to make it public.
Yeah, well, they wanted to have the film in their possession, which they actually had for several years. It's a very fragile kind of thing, and it's been in the National Archives. Even Time Inc. asked the National Archives to preserve it to humidity, temperature, that kind of thing, which they did.
Okay. We're going to take a short break now, and we'll be back with more conversation with veteran Time Life and People magazine editor Dick Stolle about covering the Kennedy assassination. This is Focus on WILL. We're back on Focus on WILL. I'm Jim Meadows, and we're talking with Pekin, Illinois native Dick Stolle, who helped cover the Kennedy assassination 50 years ago for Life magazine. He has a new article about that event in the Life magazine book, The Day Kennedy Died. And we welcome your questions, comments, or memories at 1-800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number again is 1-800-222-WILL. We've had some callers waiting patiently. I don't know if we've answered their questions yet or not, but on line one, Ned in Urbana, do you have any other questions regarding the Zapruder film or anything else about the Kennedy assassination?
Yeah, Jim, like you said, you anticipated some of my questions here, but first of all, Mr. Stolle, it's great to talk to you. I'm not a conspiracy theorist, so I want to say that up front, but I am very curious about the decisions Life made once they acquired the film. I mean, the presentation of the Zapruder film in the memorial issue that came out the week after is really extraordinary. And then there was also the decision you already mentioned to not publish or otherwise release other frames from the film. And I guess my question is, who was making those decisions? And was this is such an extraordinary situation that, for example, Henry Luce stepped in and made decisions? Or I know that C.D. Jackson, I believe, was the publisher of Life at the time. Was he making these decisions? Or did this more or less go through the normal editorial processes, these kinds of decisions?
Well, I mean, that's a very good question. And unfortunately, I was not in New York at the time, and I only kind of know what I've been told. Lou saw the film over the weekend and concurred that Life should get it. And then the decision not to allow it to be shown on television or in movies, that had to have been a decision that Luce would, whether or not it was his decision or whether it was simply he was told and told the reasons. And usually decisions of that nature were made by the editors of the magazines. And but that was important enough that Henry Luce, I'm sure, was aware of Life's policy in regard to the Zapruder film.
Well, thank you very much.
And thank you very much for calling. I'm wondering, Dick, you talked about Abraham Zapruder as a man who was grieving when you first met him to talk about the movie of the shooting. What happened to Abraham Zapruder in later years? How did the notoriety of this film affect him?
In the book, The Day Kennedy Died, Zapruder's granddaughter, who was a published author, writes about the impact on Mr. Zapruder and on the family. The impact was enormous. First, he received bags and bags of mail, and most of it addressed simply Abraham Zapruder, Dallas, Texas. And the post office, of course, knew exactly where to deliver those. It haunted him. He had to testify before the Warren Commission investigating the assassination. He wept when the movie was showed. When he and his wife traveled, particularly in Europe, when they would sign hotel registers, desk clerks would often look up and say, "Are you the Zapruder who asking questions like that?" He gave me the original and on Monday the only other copy he had, and I realized a few weeks later that he didn't have a copy of the film, and I called him up and I said, "Mr. Zapruder, you know, you don't have a copy of that film. We can make a terrific first generation copy and send it to you." And he said, "I'm sorry, I don't want that film in my house." And he didn't. It haunted him forever. The family, interesting enough, didn't talk about it much because Zapruder himself died in 1970, only 7 years after the film was made. And, I mean, the Zapruder film has become just a catchphrase that anyone who was alive at the time knows exactly what you're talking about. And the family, in many ways, is still kind of suffers in the knowledge that a lot of people are not quite sure, but they know it's something kind of ghastly and grim, and anyone named Zapruder has to go through life with that curse.
We're talking with Dick Stolle, who was with Life magazine at the time of the Kennedy assassination, and we have a caller on line 4 from Belgium, Illinois. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Yes, good morning to you all. As I remember, I was sitting in a high school biology class my sophomore year when that thing happened. And I remember at the time that the aftermath of people going through what happened and this and everything, that I was understood that they were going to sequester many, many facts and things because of the Kennedy family didn't want it to get out for 50 years. Well, here we are at 50 years. Are we going to be finding things that we don't know, or objects that were sequestered or lost and things that might come to light? What is that, or am I totally in error with those facts?
No, you're not. For instance, that pink dress that Mrs. Kennedy wore that was so stained with blood and body parts, that has been, it's kept refrigerated in National Archives and somewhere, and at the request of the Kennedy family, I don't think that's going to be taken out and shown until 2017, something like that.
So there are things that may show up in the future.
Yes, but nothing at least in my view, of any kind of forensic importance. These are artifacts that are sequestered, as you put it, more out of concern for the kind of personal impact than historical.
Thank you very much, sir.
And thank you very much for calling. Dick, I'm wondering, because, of course, you were with Life magazine for some years after the assassination. Later, you were at People magazine. As an editor, you must have been in the position to consider articles about people still wondering about the Kennedy assassination, still wondering about possible unknown evidence or conspiracy theories. How did you handle those in the publications you oversaw?
Well, Life did a lot of paid a lot of attention to the Kennedy assassination afterwards. Only a few months after November, we did a story with Governor Connally, who had recovered from his grievous wounds.
The governor of Texas, who was also
Governor of Texas, who was in the limousine on the jump seat and badly wounded. He was convinced then, and apparently to his dying day, that there was a second shooter, that one bullet hit Kennedy and that a separate bullet hit him. His theory was that a bullet that passed through Kennedy's body and then entered his could not have done the really awful, caused the awful wounds that he suffered from that day. And I remember he came to the office and they went through it frame by frame and ran a big story, and this time we ran the frames in color, and we did run frame 313. And so we continued. At one point, Life ran an editorial saying that the magazine, like so many others, was not satisfied with the Warren Commission and that the investigation should be reopened. So now, I was not involved. This was done in New York, and at that point, I did do a story when I was in the Washington Bureau, which I went to a few months after Dallas. Mrs. Kennedy's office called up and said that they were going to mount an exhibit of the things that were in the Oval Office when Kennedy was president. And the idea was to raise money for what eventually became the Kennedy Center at Harvard. And the question was, would Life magazine be interested in doing such a story? And I said, we would, on two conditions: that we can get a cover photograph of Mrs. Kennedy and that she will grant me an interview. Well, the answer was yes on the cover, no on the interview. But we did do a story, and as a result of the story, the Kennedy family was very pleased. I was invited to the opening of the exhibit in New York, and I met Mrs. Kennedy for the first and only time.
Mm. Was there anything meaningful out of that meeting with her?
I walked in. First, I met Teddy Kennedy, and who introduced me to Bobby, who I had known to some extent. And then Bobby turned to Jackie and said, this is Dick Stolle from Life. And she looked at me, and those eyes opened up. And in this incredibly breathy voice, she said, "Oh, Mr. Stolle, that was such a wonderful story." Well, I kind of melted away at that point.
I want to turn now, while we still have time. We have about 6 minutes left, and there was another important meeting that you were part of when you were covering the Kennedy assassination for Life, and that was, I guess, helping to arrange the meeting for an interview with the wife and the mother of Lee Harvey Oswald. And I'm just wondering about the memories you have about that event and what you were able to size up from meeting the Oswald family.
Well, Tommy Thompson, who was the correspondent who went there, he said, "I know Texas cops. Let me go after that part of the story," which he did. He got an exclusive interview with members of the Oswald family and photographs, almost none of which we ran back then, but they are in this new book, incredible set of photographs. Tommy called me up and said he's got this terrific story. Other reporters had not showed up yet, but they certainly were going to. He said, I think we should hide the family. Now, this may sound kind of horrifying, but I agreed immediately, and we brought them into the hotel, Adolphus, and put them in a suite.
It does sound like something out of the front page, yes.
Well, we were competitive back then, so we did. And they came into, we had set up this suite as kind of an office, and they came in, and I tell you, this was a woebegone a family as I've ever seen. I mean, they were just despondent, depressed. It was Marina, who spoke almost no English at that point.
The wife of Lee's
wife. The brother, Robert, two tiny daughters, and Lee and Robert's mother, Marguerite Oswald, who I hope it's not libelous to say, who was a true nutcase. And she was the most vocal of all. But we hid them away, said, please don't open the door or answer the phone, but order anything you want to from room service. Robert, at that point, said he needed diapers and baby food for these two daughters, and I gave him $40.
Okay. And did you meet them ever again after that?
I've spoken to Marina a couple of times on the phone. Her English is much, much better. And she has changed her mind about her husband's involvement. And at first she denied it entirely. Then she began acknowledging it. And now, in effect, she acknowledges it, but says there was a conspiracy that other people were involved.
Your own feeling is that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone.
That is my firm belief.
Okay. Nothing pans out, and you've certainly looked at a lot of materials, and considering the files that you went over to write this new article, there's nothing there that you feel that would justify.
There are unanswered questions about before and after. But Oswald was alone up there on the sixth floor. He was a good marksman. Dealey Plaza is unbelievably small. It wasn't that hard a shot. But I also do not think that he had any help from, you know, some mysterious forces before or afterwards. He was a killer. I mean, after he shot the president, he shot down a Dallas cop. He was a very disturbed young man.
Okay. And you don't think that the actions by the shooting of Oswald by Jack Ruby would have been a part of any larger conspiracy to keep things quiet?
That Monday, I wanted to find out about Ruby, so we went to the Carousel Club, the strip club that he ran. Because we were life, we talked our way in. And two of his dancers were there, and they kept saying, oh, my God, that it was it was so Jack. He thought he was going to be a hero. He didn't want Mrs. Kennedy to have to come back to Dallas for a trial. He thought if he got rid of Oswald, he would be a hero. They kept using that word, hero, and I'm utterly convinced that's exactly why he did it.
And it's interesting. There are some telegrams that are printed in the day Kennedy died, addressed to Jack Ruby, essentially congratulating him from various people for shooting Lee Harvey Oswald. One last question, just cleaning up from a Twitter question we had from Brandon about the release of that Zapruder film through Geraldo Rivera using a bootleg copy. He's asking, if Time Life had the film, who made the bootleg?
We gave copies of the film to law enforcement agencies of all over Washington, State Department, CIA, Dallas PD. There were many copies out there, and and bootleg copies, I think, were probably, they started making those within days after the assassination.
Well, we are out of time here. Of course, there's a whole lot more to talk about here, and a whole lot more will be talked about in the next few days to come. Dick Stolle, I bet you have a pretty busy schedule yourself because of this anniversary.
It brings back many memories, as you can well imagine.
Well, Dick, thank you very much for being on Focus today. Dick Stolle, an editor for Time, Life, and People magazines, thank you for sharing your memories and thoughts about the Kennedy assassination, which occurred 50 years ago, 1 week from tomorrow. You can read Dick's article on his own experiences covering the assassination in The Day Kennedy Died, published by Life Books. And we welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website. You can go to it directly at will.illinois.edu/focus. We're likely the first result in your search engine under WYLL Focus. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft is our technical director. Sari Lesk is our intern, helping with production and research. Tomorrow on Focus, another show offering personal financial advice for you, and we'll be welcoming your calls and emails. Remember, Focus is live each weekday morning at 10, a replay at 10 p.m. You can hear us over the air on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. This is Focus on WYLL.